Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of LLP. I hope you've all had a great week. This is Matt and Eric here.
Hello.
Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit. Today, we're going to be talking about getting ready for deer hunting season. I think we've got one heck of a deer hunting season ahead of us, and I thought it would be helpful to throw together a podcast for some of our fellow hunters that are trying to kind of go through the minutiae of, you know, hey, what do you do to get ready for deer hunting season? What should you do in your hunting area? What are some of the things you need to get on your checklist to take care of? So we'll go through this, and you know, really, we need to talk about it anyway, so we thought it'd be a great opportunity to include you guys in on it. I would like to thank our friends at Arkin Optics. I'm telling you, if you're looking for a great budget optic that can still deliver the goods, very rugged, excellent warranty. I mean, we have torture tested the crap out of these things. Look no further. These guys were founded by military veterans with a lot of experience, especially in the sniping realm. Their reticles are great, and they've got some good real-world experience that they put into their optics. And check them out, Arkin Optics, really good friends of the channel, and a big thanks to them for supporting our efforts here on YouTube. Deer hunting is so much fun. I really enjoy it. And I think it's also important, Matt, for us to talk about the location that we're deer hunting. You know, we are going to be hunting in South Georgia. So the Southeast, has its, you know, certain, you know, type of, let's just say, situations you want to look into for deer hunting that might differ. So it does depend a little bit on where you are geographically in the United States, because, you know, this is a big place. And, you know, you might have to tweak some of these things a little bit for your area. But generally, the stuff we're going to talk about applies pretty readily no matter where you might be.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, geographic location plays a huge part into not only that, obviously, the type of deer you're hunting, but their behavior as well, because deer behave differently in different locations. And I think we were up in East Tennessee hunting, and the guide was telling us he used to hunt in like Mississippi, Alabama, and he said those deer are skittish. He's like, you just look at them and they're just gone. Mm-hmm. He's like, you have to shoot them in the butt, you know, because yeah. They're always running from you.
I think that a lot of it does come down to, you know, where people are used to hunting and the amount of pressure that deer are under in certain areas and everything mm-hmm. like that. And, you know, there's a lot to consider, such as their habitat, you know, their bedding areas, what they're eating, the amount of food they have access to. I mean, like if you are hunting deer up in Iowa or up in Indiana with all those cornfields, yeah. I mean, they grow some straight up huge bruiser deer up there because they have so much food to eat.
They look like bodybuilder deer.
They do.
You know,
they
look like they're on steroids. You're like, holy cow.
That's right. And some areas just produce large deer. You know, it could come down to the amount of protein they have access to, the water sources, their food sources, the lack of predators. I mean, we could go on forever about what makes a deer grow larger in one area versus another. But for the purposes of today's podcast, we're going to talk about what our plans are to get ready for deer season. And what we're going to talk about, some equipment we're going to be running this year that's new. We're going to be talking about some upcoming videos that we're going to be. So I'm actually kind of giving up some secrets here. So if some of you are really into our deer hunting content, you're going to love this episode because we're going to go into some of the details on rigs we're going to be using this year to deer hunt, and we're going to film these hunts. So we're kind of laying it out, which is going to surprise. You know, if you want to be surprised, maybe not listen to this part of the podcast, but we are going to lay out some of the guns we're using this year as well. So, you know, I guess the first thing to kind of do is, you know, you go in and generally most people, if you've got stands that are already set up on your property and established, it's always a good idea to get in kind of early, and you want to check them for safety. Let's go over some safety considerations.
Yes.
First.
You know, I am not a huge tree stand hunter. Quite frankly, they kind of give me the heebie-jeebies, and that only goes back to my father falling out of one and like literally like just shattering his leg. He had like metal plates in his ankle fusing. I was like, it's like, ooh. And imagine being a little kid and like literally like maybe like 6 or 7. And that's your first experience, like knowing what a tree stand is. It's like, oh, you fell out of a tree stand.
For sure.
So, and I mean, we hunt out of tree stands, but it's not my first choice. They do feel very, very shaky, especially when the wind blows. You're just like, the first time the tree was moving and like it literally was like, yeah. it pulls the tree stand. So make sure that's ratchet strapped down, that you have a really good secure strap on there, and that those metal teeth are actually like existent, because they do break off. So make sure those metal teeth are just clamped in there.
Well, I think safety is an important consideration, and I think that it's also an interesting point as well. You know, that when you're dealing with getting around and walking around, okay, so that's mm-hmm. important. Get around on your get on your property and walk around. Start looking for sheds. Go and check your stands on foot. You know, see how your stands look when you're walking up to them. You know, take a saw with you. That's important. I recommend those little Corona folding pocket saws. Grab one of those, strap it on your belt, and just take it with you so you have it. Climb up in your stand, have a look. Saw any branches out of the way that might be obscuring your view within reason. So that's important. Always make sure, you know, don't wait until you go out to hunt the first morning of deer season that you're going to go out and to only realize, oh, well, there's giant branches are in my way, or there's a bunch of crap in my way. And now
that is
I can,
the worst. Yeah.
So you want to go and make sure you're trimming away any limbs. And also when you're climbing the ladder stand, if it's an established stand, any limbs that are like, you know, in the way of the rungs, you know, get those out of the way, because you don't want to be trying to get up in a deer stand in, you know, the middle of pitch black and trip on something, or, you know, reach and grab something and, you know, you accidentally grab the wrong thing and now you're grabbing a branch and falling. So make sure your stand is orderly and clean, strapped down, safe. Check it for structural integrity. Obviously, all of those safety considerations. But we'll talk a little bit about food plots and getting around your property and looking for sheds. So looking for sheds is pretty important, because that can give you a pretty solid idea of how many bucks might be coming through and dropping. Also, I mean, obviously, if you're finding large sheds,
right,
then that lets you know there's some decent bucks in the area, which is always a good sign. And sometimes you can, you know, if you're patient enough to walk the property, which you and I are going to go down and look for sheds next week or so, or probably after range day, we're going to go down and look for sheds. And we'll just walk around, and almost like doing a timber cruise, where you may do a 50 by 50 foot section and kind of just walk and zigzag through or whatever. We'll just get on a line and walk around in some of our areas and look for sheds.
Right.
So that's one way. And obviously, like tracking, looking for, you know, deer signs, whether it's scrapes and rubs, which of course, you know, once the deer are getting out of velvet, they're going to really begin to scrape away all of that, which essentially when they're growing their antlers, they get this fleshy crap all around their antlers. And after a while, it begins to kind of itch, almost like a scab would itch on your arm. And they will rub this off, all this material. So that velvet, you'll see little chunks of crap laying everywhere sometimes, but you'll see the trees where there's fresh scrapes. So you always want to look for fresh scrapes and fresh rubs on the trees, which can give you an indication of, you know, they're in velvet and they're trying to, you know, get all that, the crap off their antlers and everything like that. So that's important to look for. And then plots. You know, I'm a fan of hunting over food plots. I do enjoy it. And I think that there, when it comes to deer management, I think that what a lot of people tend to not really consider as a holistic part of hunting and as a holistic part of deer management is that plots are an important part of that. And I think you should always plant summer plots and winter plots. Well, people will say, well, why would you bother planting a summer plot when you can't hunt during the summer? Well, you still want your deer to be healthy.
Yeah.
And because the thing is healthy does drop healthy bucks. So the healthier mama is, the healthier the baby's going to be. I mean, that like prenatal care, right? It's the same type of thing. Like, you know, mom has to have proper nutrition so that she's going to drop a healthy buck, and that buck is going to have the best chance he can to grow up into a decent deer that is going to have, you know, and genetics come into play, of course. But at the end of the day, no matter what that deer might be, he still needs to be healthy and have the good nutrition. So we feed throughout the year. We plant summer and winter plots. We got our plots in a little bit late this year, but we're planting a five-way, what they call a five-way. and, you know, bust up your plots, get your stuff in. You know, it's always a good opportunity to go and check on your plots, make sure things are looking good. Maybe do a soil test prior to that to make sure that the, you know, the acidity level and the pH level, like there's all these things you can test. You can get a soil test kit and it'll give you an idea of what you might have to add, maybe nitrates or whatever to the soil to get that, that level of soil where it needs to be to perform the best.
I agree. And managing your land and your deer herd is a year round thing. Yeah. And you know, you don't have to do it year round. It's good to, because you do have to make sure that those does are taken care of, that they're comfortable, that they're not being pressured. Because, you know, when you have large swaths of land and we're talking, you know, maybe 500, 600 acres up into the thousands, it's not a fast process. Like it does take a little bit of time to manage those different, you almost do it in quadrants. So you're planning your food plots, you're making sure those deer are happy, you know, they're eating healthy. Like you said, when they're, rubbing their velvet, it looks really gnarly. Like if you catch one on a deer cam and like you just got like stuff, bloody, you know, velvet hanging off their tines, you're just like, what just happened? Did he just kill something? Because it looks gnarly, man. It's like blood and gut. It looks like guts hanging off of his antlers.
Yeah.
But, you know, to go back to the food plot hunting, like I like hunting over food plots as well. And people have this connotation of like, oh, it's you're just shooting them when they eat. But if you're really going for like a headgear, or you're really after a specific deer, when you're watching your deer cams, you're trying to track that deer, like the one that you want. You name them. You're tracking him around your property. Just because you're over this food plot doesn't necessarily mean that's he's going to come in on that plot. You still have to do your part.
Sure.
You still have to find him and make sure that you're in the right place at the right time of day or night. It's still very challenging.
Well, I think a good winter forage is great in terms of food plots, and you can get into some different stuff. Like you could plant some winter rye, some clay peas, winter peas. I mean, there's all these different things that you can plant that the deer like to eat and everything like that. And that just kind of keeps them coming through, right? So like if you got some good forage just growing throughout the winter months, heck, even into November, possibly even December, depending on how temperate your climate is. I mean, where we're at in South Georgia, we can get away with a pretty good bit. So we like planting a solid five-way, and we feed them corn too. Now, depending on the area that you live in, you know, and everything, your laws might vary, you know, quite a bit compared to where we are, but where we're at, you can bait. And I like feeding them corn. I would say in an average year, we probably feed our deer between 4,000 and 5,000 pounds of corn a year.
We went through a lot of corn.
We went through an entire gondola of corn. It was like several thousand pounds.
Yeah, it was insane, man.
We pour it out in 5-gallon buckets. And, you know, we do have some feeders. You know, there is some logic to, you know, when a deer hears a feeder, they're kind of programmed to go, ooh, food. There is that aspect, but I like just getting them used to coming into a pile of corn on the ground in line.
And
I found that to be the most effective.
But it also gives you the opportunity to gauge, you know, how active that area is. When you have a feeder, you kind of become reliant on, like, we hope that they're eating the corn, and the corn that's on the ground, you don't know if it's been there for a day or 2 days or 3 days. But when we're out there actively throwing corn, we can judge at the moment, oh man, they're eating this corn up. We're going to sit here, or we're going to put somebody on this stand because they just decimated this corn that we put out yesterday.
And I feel like having a large, you know, like a 5-gallon bucket worth of corn out in a line on the ground, if you are going to hunt over corn, I feel like having that corn physically out on the ground and in the air where they can smell it brings them in a lot better too. You know, they might be a long ways off. Deer's got a great nose, right? They can really smell, you know, they live and die by that nose. So if there's corn on the ground, they're going to smell it. And I just feel like having the corn accessible and letting them eat what they want, when they want, as much as they want, and having just all that much more on the ground is even better. Now, I want to pass along something I learned about protein that I've been making a mistake about in the last, you know, several years. In fact, it took me a while to learn this. You're supposed to mix protein pellets with corn. I didn't know that. I was laying, you know, pellets out, the protein pellets, like in its own little line, and we would come out there, and the protein pellets would just have like mold and crap on them, thinking, well, why aren't they eating this? You know, what the heck are we doing wrong? What, do they not like protein? you're supposed to mix it. And I didn't know that. And I've been making that rookie mistake for years, and that's a bought lesson. And if you're going to run some protein, maybe run, you know, 30-60, something like that, 33-66. Run about a third of your mix, protein, and the rest of it corn. And mix it real well, and they'll eat it. There's also some blends that people have been using that I really do want to experiment with this year. There's a gentleman out in Texas that does this type of corn that's got powdered protein added into it with the corn, as well as like orange zest, like orange peel that they grind up, orange peels.
It makes sense.
And the scent.
Yes.
You know, it's not only the orange peels are adding, I guess, some type of nutritional value, but also the smell. It brings them in. You know, they love the smell of orange zest and fruit.
Well, that's
apples.
A smart move, because that keeps you from having to buy a secondary product like crush that, you know, normally you would put out on top of the corn. So we would put out corn or protein, and then you're laying crush down on top. He's integrating it into the food.
That is a fantastic point. Now, I do like using those protein bags. I have like the Candy Crush. Look, I fall for those marketing stunts. Like, I buy those products. Now, there's probably some uber professional deer hunter that will tell you, oh, that crap's a waste of money. Don't buy the Khmer deer and the cane sugar. Look, here's the thing. It works, okay? I'm telling you, it works. And I never considered just mixing it in with the corn.
Oh, there you go.
We need to do that. So we're going to mix the protein in with the corn. We're going to mix the crushes and all those other things in with the corn. I'm a believer. I love mineral blocks and salt blocks. And on our property, we've got many, many areas where it's like an established lick. Like, there's a huge spot in the ground. It stays wet, and it's just a mineral lick. And they always come to those salt blocks, mineral blocks. If there's a source of water nearby, you definitely want to have the salt blocks handy. They love them. They just love them. I don't know any other way to explain it. Sometimes, if you've got a stump in your hunting area, maybe you've got a wide open area with a nice rotted out stump, that's a great place to start a lick. Take yourself, this is going to sound crazy, but this is what I do. And look, I'm a redneck here. I'm just telling you what we do.
Redneck science, man. It works.
You can just dump some apple cider in it if you want, or something like that. Or, you know, they make some commercial products that are like, you know, the Khmer deer in the big jar, and you can dump it on a stump. That works too. Also, look, go to Sam's Club or somewhere like that and get you a cheap thing of peanut butter, big old thing of peanut butter, and put some nitrile gloves on and just grab that peanut butter and cover that stump in peanut butter and watch the hilarity ensue. So there's a lot of things that are food related that will obviously bring deer more to your hunting area, whether it's food plots, corn, mineral licks, salt blocks, and any other number of food related things. I mean, without getting into scents, which we will get into scents and things as well, but I'm a believer in hunting over food. All right. People can say what they want, but it's like, if I'm running a camera and I'm trying to get a shot, or I'm trying to just harvest a doe for the refrigerator, you know, I want food. Or even if I'm hunting headgear, you know, I can still rattle.
Yeah.
I can still, you know, use calls or whatever.
I think you rattled in a big buck last season.
I did.
Like right there at was it Squirrel Town? Or?
No, that was over at a place we call the Hippie Stand.
Yeah, we apologize for using the stand names, because we know the stands, you guys don't. So you might hear some really wonky stand names, but that's how we know where we're at on the property.
The thing is on the video, whenever we make our hunting videos, we'll always talk about the stand we're in by its name. So over time, as you watch our hunting content, you'll learn the names and the locations.
Yeah. And you'll get the story behind it, like why they got the name.
Yeah, every stand has sharing a story. Those stories.
Now, but, I will tell you, last season you did not live fruit, but fresh fruit. It was like you got fruit from the grocery store that was on its way out. So like it was like 1 or 2 days from not being able to be sold, or like they had already pulled it off the shelf. It was still good. It wasn't rotten, but it was just a little too soft. And we cut that up. Like the pears and like the apples, and like, man, those deer decimated that
they
stuff.
They love
man.
Fresh fruit.
Yes,
so
they came in and they just killed
I'm
it.
I'm not suggesting, and now look, there's going to be a lot of people, Matt, that will give you grief for hunting over food, and they'll say, that's not really hunting or whatever. And I don't want to take away from the sanctity of spot and stalk. Look, I enjoy a spot and stalk. I love to just walk around and look for deer, but the difficulty in that for me is like if we're trying to film something, that's really hard to try to maneuver a camera or maneuver a tripod and stalk the deer. Like, it adds an extremely difficult level challenge that also requires a heck of a lot more time to really get in there. So I have become more of a stand hunter, mainly just by virtue of the fact that it just makes filming a lot easier to do it from a ground blind or stand. So let's talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about some of the choice differences between a ladder stand or a box blind or a ground blind. Like, what are the advantages and disadvantages of those two types of concealment when it comes to hunting? Well, I think the obvious, you know, advantage to a tall blind or a ladder stand is that you're higher in the air and you have a better perspective and you can see more. Yep. The higher you are in the air, that's an advantage.
A better vantage point. You can see more terrain. Yep. Definitely the scent, like you're not at nose level. Your scent isn't being carried while you're in the stand, at least for the most part, as much as you would be if you were on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, I would probably say those are the two most, they're easier to set up, like, meaning they're harder to set up in the beginning, but you don't have to like trek it in, because some people will like trek in like a portable stand and then set it up and try to go through this whole motion because they like to move around their property.
That's a viable tactic.
And I would probably say the biggest disadvantage is it's cold.
Yeah.
It is extremely cold. Like, that's one of the reasons, like, I just don't like doing it. It's in the morning times, like when we're getting out of the cabin and on into the stand. Like, Eric, okay, if you guys don't know, Eric likes to like get in there early. I'm talking like we're in the stand at 4 o'clock, guys. Like, we'll go our separate ways.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely freezing. And I refuse to sit in a tree stand at 4 a.m, man.
Sometimes people don't like going hunting with me because I'm one of those guys. I will get up and have coffee at 4 a.m. And I will get in the stand an hour and 45 minutes before first light.
But I'll tell you what, we've seen a deer every single time. There's never been a time where I got into the blind or the stand and I didn't see a deer. So if I wanted to, I could have taken it. But most of them walk.
I remember I took John and Shermichael hunting. And the first time we hunted the W, it was with John and I. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, you know, we took the Polaris into, you know, we walked in a pretty decent way. Yeah. You know where we park.
Yeah.
We walk in probably a quarter mile. I mean, it's a pretty good little ways. It's a decent walk. But you have to cross this dam.
Yep.
And he was like, you know, we're going to break out a flashlight?
No.
We're walking in the dark. And like, I just use the moonlight and let my eyes adjust. That's why I get in early. So I'll park. I'll get my rifle, my kit, whatever. We're getting out of line for what we're talking about stands. But this is important about approaching a stand. And I always check the wind. And I walk in with no light. And I just take my time and I creep really slow. And we were crossing the dam. He's like, I hear water. I'm like, yeah, we're
walking over the dam,
you know? Yeah. And I was like, well, hopefully if there's a gator hanging out, he'll just slither out of the way. Yep. And he's like, what?
And there are gators that live on both sides of that. Yeah. It's literally like if you could imagine playing a Nintendo game where you're walking across the skinny strip of land, just like gators chomping at you on both sides.
It ain't quite that bad, but it is a consideration. Yep. But the point is, I love hunting stories, and I could tell hunting stories all day, but approaching the stand is always a challenge. And yes, you're right. I do like to get up really, really early, and sometimes people are like, God, why are you getting up so early? But I have success. I mean, people can say what they want. So different stands. We get back to that. Yes, ladder stands can be brutal because, you know, they are quite cold. And then sometimes, let's say if you're sitting in an exposed ladder stand with nothing around it, no cloth or no enclosure, you have to be still.
Extremely still.
So
you can't move at all.
If you've got stiff joints or maybe you got arthritis or maybe you just prefer to be able to move around just a little bit and be comfortable, you know, that can be a little bit more challenging in an exposed ladder stand because you're exposed to the elements and you have to be much more still. Yeah.
Well, even setting up the shot, you have to be extremely still because the few times that I've sat up there, I mean, I've taken a shot, but even just maneuvering the rifle, you have to just move, and you have to pray to God that that deer is still so hungry that he's going to, then you're just like, please don't move. Please right. don't, like, just take in your time.
Yep. It is a challenge.
It is, but the wind, man, I remember one time the wind was blowing so hard, and that tree is just, dude, like, I don't know where you got these ladder stands. These are like extra tall ladder stands, because it's like, these should not be that high. Like, if you saw this anywhere else, it looks like you're climbing to the top of a telephone pole. I'm just like, holy crap, I'm not climbing up there. I mean, I climbed up it. But when you get up there, like, that tree is swaying, and these are humongous trees. You feel like you're going to get, like, flung out of there, like a Wile E. Coyote, how the tree bends and just, like, slingshots you out.
It's sketchy.
Yes, it's sketchy at best.
So, some advantages of an enclosed tower stand would be, okay, now we're talking an enclosed stand that's on some sort of a tower or platform. We built ones that we call the Ritz-Carltons, and we basically just built them from, you know, some basic ideas from scratch. Nothing overly, you know, intricate, but they're nice. They got carpet. They're fairly large. I'd say they're a 4x8 sheet floor size.
Yeah, like OSB type deal.
Yeah, decent size. Now, that's the best of both worlds, because you got a carpeted floor. You can move your hands, move your feet, look at your phone.
That's the big thing.
Drink coffee. Yeah. I mean, there's so much more
buddy heaters. You got buddy heaters. Like, very important.
You got heaters. So there are some levels of comfort to an enclosed stand that certainly can warrant that, especially if someone's more elderly. Maybe they have a little bit harder time getting around, and they need to be able to move a little more. Or maybe they just, you know, they get cold easily and they need a heater. I mean, look, we got to deal with that. That's just part of it, right? You know, and for us maneuvering cameras and things like that, it's just easier to film from inside an enclosed stand. And that's what we did with John and Sir Michael. And now on the ground blinds, what are some advantages of ground blinds? Well, for one, if you've got a portable ground blind, and let's say you're a solo hunter doing it all by on your own, you have a lot of ability to kind of, maybe you could just go out a day or two before your hunt and do some scouting and go, wow, I didn't see this 4 weeks ago.
Yep.
Maybe I ought to hunt right here. Maybe throw a little corn out, and then one morning maybe go get in early, set up a pop-up blind, and you'd be surprised, you know.
Yeah.
You can sneak up on them.
The deer are just as surprised as you are, because they're not used to being pressured. They're in a part of the woods that they've never seen anybody. They don't even know what humans look like. You just happen to trek into that part, that corner of your property, and then bam!
Ground blinds have their place.
Yep.
And then we've got you guys might have heard of a company called Baronet Blinds. I've got a Baronet on a place we call a coyote stand. In that area, it's this huge blind with super rigid sides, mesh.
Now a word nice from our chairs. Sponsors.
No, what's that?
I said, now a word from our sponsor.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, we're not the traditional hunting show, but the thing is, a fixed position ground blind is awesome too, because if it's a good quality one, like our Baronet, we probably should take that blind up every year, but we don't. It's under a big oak tree, and it's literally been in the weather for 4 years,
but it has been covered.
It's held up.
Yeah, I mean where we have it at is
the tree.
Keeps a lot of that UV light. It's never in direct sunlight. It's in a very shaded area, and I think it's been there ever since you allowed me to come hunting with you on that property, and it's held up great.
Yeah,
I mean, you have a lot of freedom of movement. You can, you know, you got the mesh over.
It's
like,
huge.
One, you're covered from the neck down. Two, you have the mesh that covers up, so you can kind of move. If you need to scratch your nose, if you need to wipe your eye, you know, that gives you a lot of latitude on what you can and can't do. And I think just having the freedom to just do those small micro movements, because you still aren't going to go crazy, guys. In a ground blind, you're still not going to start, you know, go crazy arms and start, you know, freaking out. But it gives you that, you know, latitude of doing the head movements and like, you know, moving around a little bit. Adjusting your chair, like, you know, just posturing up a little bit. I don't honestly, outside of like being more, you know, noticeable on the scent level, at the nose level, I don't see any downside to a ground blind.
Oh, no, not at all.
I mean,
we control our scent. You know, I am a big fan of scent sprays. I really like, you know, using the scent spray. I think it's a very crucial part. But of course, playing the wind is a super important aspect, yes, of not getting busted by deer. You know, that's more of a strategy thing. But ground blinds have their place. And I think in terms of getting ready for deer hunting season, don't overlook ground blinds. Don't overlook ladder stands. We bought another ground blind last year that has this 3D mesh in it. It's really cool because you can take the hard walls down and the deer can't see in, but you can see out. And it's kind of weird when you're sitting in it because you feel super exposed.
Right.
Because it seems like because you can see out, you would think, oh, they're going to see me. But you see them and they don't see you. And I kind of like that too, because if you hear a little movement, you don't really have to worry so much about being super still. You can just, you can move around because the only exposed areas that they could actually see you are through the shooting ports, and you can leave those closed. So you can move around all you want. You could
just don't turn your flashlight on inside because it's like a two-way mirror. Like, you know, if you're behind that two-way mirror, they can't see you until you turn the light on. And then once you illuminate the inside, they can see
you. Yeah, they can see you pretty easily. Yeah, and you have to close the back. You can't let the daylight come through. But overall, I think that there's a lot of awesome technology for stands, and I know that there's a lot of different ways of thinking when it comes to how someone chooses to handle their deer hunt. Some people are more spot and stalk, which I do enjoy that. I don't have as much experience with spot and stalk because everything we do is in the context of trying to film and stuff, so we choose to use the ground blinds and the box blinds and ladder stands just because it makes life easier for us to film our hunts, which is super important to me. We do have the Tacticams we're going to be experimenting with this year. I want to talk a little bit about some of the guns that we're going to use. So I've been saying for years that I'm going to do a deer hunt and take down a deer with our Fugly, the Mosin, the SBR Mosin. I know you guys have probably seen it. It's that ugly green Obrez Mosin that we had. It's got a AAC 51 tooth muzzle brake on it that accepts my SDN6 suppressor, 7.62x54R with a 10.5-inch barrel. And I know people would think, well, this gun can't be very effective, or you're not getting very good velocity. In our testing, it actually holds up really well. Even with a 10.5-inch barrel, it's getting some very good velocity that is most certainly lethal on deer inside of a few hundred yards. No questions asked. I'm just going to run some factory Barnall 203s in it, maybe some 180 grain soft points. That's about, I'm just going to, you know, run whatever I can find off the shelf because projectiles are so hard to get right now. You know, I considered maybe loading some Barnes projectiles, but those Barnes 311s have been almost impossible to get. So I'm just going to opt for some factory ammo in it. And yeah, we're going to try to harvest a deer with the 7.62x54, which oddly enough, I think the only thing that we've shot with that are the hogs out of the PSL when we were up in Tennessee.
That's right.
I've never shot a deer with 7.62x54. So a 10.5-inch barrel Mosin with a suppressor, why not? We'll give old Fugly a chance to put some meat on the ground.
Yeah.
That's one thing we're planning on doing in terms of gear this year.
You may have to make that a close shot. I don't know. I don't know how much distance you're going to get out of that before it falls out of the sky like a rock.
Well, it's funny you say that because if you watch the original video, it actually shoots a lot flatter than you think, and it groups a lot better than you think. And most of our shots down here are under 200 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, with the majority, 80% of them are under 100 yards.
Yeah.
So it will absolutely. So I got with Leupold, and I'm going to get a scout scope for it, an extended eye relief scout optic, which my Obrez Mosin SBR is set up with a rock solid industry scout mount, so that it can still be loaded with stripper clips, because that's kind of like the thing with scout rifles, the whole Jeff Cooper concept. I doubt I'm going to need stripper clips of extra ammo to go deer hunting, but we're going to put a scout scope on it. Right now, it's got a red dot, and it's effective, but for deer hunting, I do like a bit of magnification, and I do like the light gathering characteristics of Leupold optics.
Yep.
And everything like that, and I do like the fact that, you know, it can help me more positively identify my game a little bit better, especially in low light situations. So I like the magnification just to help me make the shot. My eyes aren't as good as they used to be, so I'm trying to, you know, be, you know, good towards my deer. I don't want to wound a deer.
You know, and that's a very important, you know, attribute, because you see it time and time again, people taking shots they shouldn't take. They get antsy, like they're getting towards last light. the optics not gathering enough light, and they're just kind of, they're not able to positively identify how big it is or how far it is or where that round's going to go, and they end up wounding deer. And, you know, I felt terrible when I thought I had done it, but we ended up finding it. It was just, you know, completely in the wrong place. It just jumped off somewhere. But I wanted to get your opinion on something. And just
there's no worse feeling than wounding a deer.
Oh, yeah.
No one wants to do that.
About the ground blinds, and I will just jump out of that once we get this over with. Do you think that it's a good idea to place the ground blind when it's not hunting season so the deer get used to it?
Oh, yeah. In terms of preparing for hunting season, in my experience, especially with any type of permanent fixture you're going to put in place, whether it's a feeder, whether it's even a camera in some cases, a stand, whatever it may be, it is helpful, you know, to get them used to seeing it. If it's something that's going to be there every day, you probably want to get it established as soon as possible. And some would argue, hey, you need to put it up in the spring so that it can be there. In my experience, from observing cameras, which I do want to talk about cameras a bit before we get too much further on the gun aspect, but in my experience, if it's there for 3 or 4 weeks, they're going to be used to it. But obviously, the longer the better. I mean, if you've got more time and you can leave something permanently in place, you know, the longer it can be established, probably the better, especially a ground blind. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to put a ground blind too close to the game trail, like where you know they're passing through. You need to offset it a bit because you don't want them to come across. You don't want to put a ground blind right in the middle of where they're walking. They're going to be like, what's this? You know, so you want it to be Sneaky Pete somewhere where maybe they don't go very often so that they just walk right by it.
You know, I was thinking, and what brought that up was, they make those ground blinds that look like hay bales, and I sent it over to you. The thing is, in where we're at, we don't have hay bales. We have cotton bales. So maybe I should call them up and petition them to make the same blind in a cotton bale design so you can get, and these things are not nice, man. Like, they're huge. Going like 2-3 man blinds, but they look just like bales of hay. They have little windows that drop down.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
There's a lot of options. And honestly, I think at the end of the day, you know, deer are smart, don't get me wrong, but they really rely on that nose. So as long as you're doing proper scent control, as long as you are playing the wind properly, and as long as you're not making a lot of noise and really moving slow, I mean, you can walk around and spot and stalk. You don't even have to be in a blind to effectively hunt deer as long as you, you know, take care of those elements in the proper way. So, blinds withstanding. All right. We talked about food. We talked about blinds. I kind of hinted that we were going to be getting some shots in with Fugly this year and taking down, some deer on film, with Fugly, which believe it or not, a lot of people have been asking me to do. They want to see me hunt with this rifle. So we are going to do that. It's been many years in the making. We are finally going to get those, shots in this year. I can't wait for that. Let's talk a little bit about sighting in your gun. I mean, that's obviously important. I mean, look, guys, I think it goes without saying. I mean, take some time, go out the range, check your zero. You know, if you're going to change loads or change bullet grain weight or change your optic, you know, maintain your equipment. I mean, I think we're all preaching to the choir here. I'd like to think that folks that are tuning in and getting ready for deer hunting season, they know to go out and obviously check your zero and things like that and clean your rifle and, you know, all of those sorts of things. So that goes without saying that if you're going to change some of your equipment or if it's the same rifle you've been using for 10 years, doesn't matter. You should take it out, check your zero. Guns get bumped around. Humidity and temperature changes can cause some weird anomalies. So, you know, you want to make sure your equipment is capable and that you're ready to take the shot if you need to.
And I'll tell you an example of that is what happened last season when we went with the handgun hunt. I zeroed in my 44 mag, 8.5-inch barrel. I climbed up the ladder to get into the, it wasn't a tree stand, it was a tower blind. And we had chest holsters, or I have a chest holster, and I get up into the top rung of the ladder and I bend over and my revolver falls out of my chest holster because I failed to button up the strap that holds it in and it falls right onto the optic. And I said to myself, I was like, man, I really hope nothing happened. Well, sure enough, we sat there for first light. First light came in. There was, you know, a couple deer just hanging out. And I took the shot. By the way, I blew Chad's bag apart with the cylinder blast. Oh, man, that was hilarious.
He wasn't happy about that.
He wasn't happy about it. But, man, that 44 mag let loose and just, boom, beads everywhere. And I'll tell you, I hit the deer by, you know, God's good graces. And it, like, it went down immediately. But, man, that zero was off probably a good 6 inches, because y'all was aiming for the heart and it hit it like right in the, like right towards the spine. And, I mean, it dropped and it died, but it just, like, those are the types of things, like, they're unexpected.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like you said, the zero was off. I mean, granted, I dropped it right when I was getting into the stand, but it doesn't take much and, you know, it happens.
That's
but,
right. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that that you have to pay attention to. And so a couple of other guns that we're going to be using this year, you guys might have saw the video on my old German Cape gun. It's like a 20-bore Paradox with a 16-gauge on one side. But we did this video where we were discovering the, you know, we were discovering the caliber because we didn't know. And we had to use Sarasafe and figure this out. And we did some, you know, testing and everything, and found out that the gun's actually regulated quite well. Like, it hits precisely where it's aiming. We figured out the perfect bullet weight for it. Well, anyway, I'll try to include a photo. I shot a buck with that gun last year. I didn't film it. I really would like to harvest a deer with that gun just to show the excitement of black powder shooting. We've done some work with the Norwegian Kamalotter in the past, and I actually do hunt with that rifle, and I may hunt during black powder season with it again. But I'd like to give the 20 bore a chance to take another deer on film. So that's one thing, just a quick note, that we'll be trying to film. Also, I've carried the 50 cal Texan SS air gun with me on quite a few hunts. We are going to be doing a video on that particular gun in a hunting environment. And I think Rick is going to try to film a kill with his 50 cal SS Texan, the integral suppressed or moderated Texan.
Moderated.
Yeah, important. Moderated's the important word that they use in the airgun world. But we're both going to be running cameras on that, and I'm hoping we can put together a great episode. And I'm trying to get Rick back out in the woods and back to filming and doing the things that he's doing, because I really want to get Rick back on the channel, because it's been a long time since he's been on the channel.
He's a wealth of knowledge, man.
Yeah.
This dude is like an encyclopedia of the airgun world.
And he exposed me to airguns, especially the big bore airguns and things like that. So I'm looking forward to getting out in the woods with Rick and getting some filming done with the 50 cal Texan. That's a gun I really like. I mean, I think it's a fantastic piece of hardware. It sounds great. Mm-hmm. I finally got my bottle on my tank fixed or whatever, or my air tank repaired. I had an issue with it, and Ton over there sent me one out to replace it. So we've got it working well now. When we wrap up filming today, I'll let you shoot that 50. I think I've got it running.
Right on. And
you'll love it. It's so cool. I'm running the 340 grain Nielsen. They got a couple of different weights. I think there's a 285 and like a 340 or 345. I'm going to run the heavy in it. It doesn't quite make the energy of the lighter pill, and it uses a lot of air because it's a heavy projectile, but the accuracy's good. And for the distances I'm going to be shooting, I'm probably going to try to keep it 50 yards and in. I might take an 80-yard shot, but I'm not going to shoot it over 80. But I'm really looking forward to putting a deer on the ground with the Texan, because it's just such a cool piece of hardware. So those are a few guns. And I know Chad is going to try to take a deer with a 300 hammer this year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he bought one of those Wilson Combat 300 hammer uppers, which is like a 300 blackout on steroids.
Yeah, I remember he mentioned, he was telling me about it. It's just better than a 300 or bigger than a 300 blackout, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing. So I think he's going to try to harvest a deer with that this year. And I'm sure we want to do more revolver hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, you know, he took one with the 460. That was the last hunting video we made, was with the 460 Magnum.
Yep.
And Chad did such a great job and performed such a perfect shot on that doe. and everything like that. I think we really do want to experiment with some different projectiles.
I guess my two are just chopped liver then. I mean, don't even.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that 44 mag shot of yours was great. You shot two deer.
I know.
On one sit. So on that particular hunt, I really regret that we didn't film that. So we are going to do more revolver hunting this year, and I definitely want to try to film some of that. So sort of laying all that out, those are our major projects for this year for deer hunting. But, of course, we have some special stuff planned for hogs too, right? I've got the FX air guns. I'm trying to think of the gun that they set up for the arrow launcher. That gun is called the Crown Arrow, FX Crown Arrow. And it has their arrow launching kit.
Yep.
And we went on a hog hunt last year with some friends of ours, and we filmed a video that I don't think we're quite ready to release yet, because now we have some broadheads that do a much better job, and they have a little more weight and a little more carrying energy, and we're going to go out and kill some more hogs with this Crown Arrow from nice. FX. And I want you to come down and hang out with us for that. So for that one, that will be quite interesting.
Right on.
So we got some awesome stuff planned for deer hunting this year and just for hunting content in general. And this is one of my favorite times of year. Once we start getting into hunting season, it just is so much fun.
I think I'm going to experiment with the Benelli M4 and see what we can do with that.
You're going to shoot a deer with a shotgun?
We'll see. We shall see.
You're going to use buckshot, or are you going to try a slug?
I'll probably end up trying this slug.
Well, those ghost rings on that thing are spot on.
Yep. I will probably throw a red dot on there. I'll probably throw you know, RMR, like a cuz pistol red dots tend to work a little bit better on the M4. They sit much lower. Either that or like a Holosun 509K or something.
Could probably hook that up.
Yeah.
You know, maybe like a what weight slug you thinking? Maybe just like a 1 ounce slug?
Yeah, nothing too crazy.
Not a Bernicke Black Magic.
No, I have to like have to adjust like 6 minutes up. You know, you have to like lob
it
in.
I've got some great Remington slugs that we can try out in that thing. That I think will work quite well for you. So why don't we try that? And you know, we'll put a red dot on it, zero it.
Yep.
And you know, slug accuracy, you know. The nice thing about the Benellis is they do have the screw-in choke, so you can get some decent chokes that will help with the slug accuracy. So I think it would not be unreasonable for you to be able to kill a deer with that shotgun 75 yards an inch.
If I was going to make an educated guess, that's exactly 50. Where I would land. 50 to 75 yards and in, I think we're
try
in
to
good
get
shape.
Them within 50 yards.
Yeah, and it's all about comfort level, too. So, I mean, if I... Obviously, I have a pretty good track record.
yeah, you do.
Tooting my own horn
freaking
over here.
Freaking Ho Chi Minh over here.
I'm very well known in the property.
That's
yeah, I mean, I think I might try that out just to see how it goes.
Shotguns are great. You know, my uncle killed a lot of deer with shotguns over the years. Mm-hmm. He would just use a freaking single shot H&R with either a slug. A lot of times he used a slug. And I remember all the times that we would help him retrieve deer out of the woods, you know, we would just hear boom, you know, and it would just be like a, you know, you knew it was a shotgun blast because it kind of had that sound. And I'll tell you one thing, in my experience, you will rarely see an animal walk away from a shotgun slug.
Yeah, I would imagine
with proper shot placement. It is definitely, I mean, if you must end that encounter instantly, two-legged or four-legged, which we're not going to get into all of that, but slugs are highly effective. I mean, they have a massive wound channel. They penetrate generally just about anything, depending on the power. They don't shoot quite so flat. I mean, there's a lot of people that do the slug guns with rifle barrels in them.
Yep. Which are called slug guns. They're separate. They are a separate category.
People that hunt with slugs and that's their thing will have slug guns. And, you know, a slug gun with a proper sabo or a proper projectile that's set up to shoot through a rifle barrel. I mean, yeah, you could probably hit targets 200 yards away without any difficulty. Mm-hmm. It basically just becomes a big bore, you know, rifle at that point.
I mean, which is the trajectory of a Nerf football. You know, you just have to kind of lob it in there, even with the slug gun, because it's still just a big, massive hunk of metal going downrange.
Well, think about the Texan.
Yeah.
I mean, that 50 cal round, it does lob in. I mean, once you get beyond 100 yards, it's got a pretty elliptical trajectory that you have to be well prepared for, and you have to know your zero distance, and that's why we carry a rangefinder, just to know. Now, so that's another preparation thing, you know your ranges. You know, maybe you want to do like a little tiny range card and just sort of reorient yourself with your hunting area. If you haven't seen it in a year, get back in, glass around. Even if it's just a mental range card, you don't have to draw something out or write something down. You could just say, hey, to my left, the feeder's 80. To the front, the low-hanging branch is 100. To my right, the salt block is 100, whatever. And then you can kind of go, okay, well, maybe you take features in the terrain and then assign ranges to them. And that way you know, okay, well, the deer is at the salt block. I know it's 100 on the money. Then if I'm running my Texan, I would dial my scope or whatever and then take the shot. So sort of doing that homework is important. Like, you don't want to be trying to range a deer before you shoot it. You're wasting time.
Exactly.
You could be setting up the shot. So in my opinion, it's kind of important. Like, get settled in the stand, grab your rangefinder, reorient yourself, and that can go a long way in saving you a bit of time, especially with us trying to maneuver cameras. Mm-hmm. I've already got enough to do trying to focus a camera and then set up the shot. So I've got to shoot the deer twice.
Yep.
Because I've got to maneuver the camera and self-film.
Well, and that's where, like,
it's tough.
You're creating almost like a, you know, in the Army, we call it a range card. So when you're sitting in that stand, you have a mental range card of like, hey, we know that the first, because we'll have like some stands will have two plots. So we're like, all right, it's like 75 to the first plot. It might be 100 to the second plot. Or, you know, whatever it may be, we know that it's like 250 all the way to the end. So if you see a deer pop out back there, like in your mind, you already know. So just having those like ranges predetermined, like you already know. And it might be significantly easier if it's your property or you hunt that property regularly. It's much more difficult if you're hunting like public land because you don't have a choice on where you're going. You're kind of just walking in and, you know, I don't hunt public land. That's just, you know, personal preference on safety. I don't like to get shot at. I don't like to get any of that stuff done.
Not to mention being settled in, having somebody walk by you or something.
Yeah, or ATVs pulling in. Like, and I don't even know how the hierarchy works on a tree stand because I've heard stories about like you walking into your tree stand and like someone's sitting in your stand that you put up and you're like, well, this is kind of awkward because you're sitting in my tree stand.
Well, I think the general, you know, kind of rule of the road on that on public land is if you leave it, it's fair game. I mean, that includes someone stealing it, sitting in it, doing whatever. I mean, if you leave it, it's abandoned property.
Yep.
Now, I suppose that there are, you know, certain situations where I do hunt bears up in North Georgia. And some of the hunting properties that we go to are public properties. And, yeah, there's some little blinds and some little hidden places, if you will. And some of it's natural stuff that we put up. Like, we might take a couple of logs and move them and make a little strategic location where we can just bring pack in a blind and set a blind up, and then there we go. Or just bring a chair, and we got, you know, almost like a little embankment of wood of that we can sit behind that's natural cover.
Like a natural barrier.
That we can sit in. So we have a few areas like that where we strategically stack some logs up, and that, look, someone might walk right by it and not think twice about it being a potential hunting location, or they may, you know, think like we do and go, well, that'd be a great place to sit, and then sit there. But more times than not, generally they don't. So that's how we handle the bear hunting, is by just making ourselves little wooden areas. Now, I haven't been able to harvest a bear yet. I have been on a couple of bear hunts, and I'm hoping that's another thing that I would like to try to film this year is a bear kill, especially with the Texan or the Commilauter. Last year, I sat in my little draw there with the Commilauter, and I was prepared to shoot a bear with that, which talk about dangerous. I mean, like,
man,
if you miss, if they get mad, you're screwed. I mean, I was carrying my 686 as a backup, so I did have my 44 Magnum with me. With some 300 grain Lehighs in it, which I'm sure would dissuade even the most pissed off bear.
The most discerning bear.
Yes. The bear would be like, oh, you have the right to bear arms.
Well, we have that. So let's talk about real quick about like camo. So like preferences on camo and like what really matters, what doesn't matter, what's kind of like urban legend and all that good stuff. So
great, you know, point.
I'll kind of just go first and say orange will not affect what the deer see. Matter of fact, you could have an entire camo, when they make these, entire camo suits with orange, and you are perfectly fine. They cannot, they literally cannot see the color orange. It doesn't exist in their color spectrum.
Blue shows up the most.
Correct. And, you know, I think what it comes down to is, like, it's a fashion statement. Because, I mean, if think about this, like, why are tigers so, why are they so successful hunting in the jungles? And they're orange. It's because a lot of the prey are very similar to deer. They don't have the ability to see orange. When they see black and green or black and whatever color is supposed, what we see is orange. They don't. So if you walk out there in all orange camo, you're safe from humans because humans will definitely see it, but deer will not.
That's a great observation. And if I could impart a little wisdom on camo, what I would tell people, if you're getting ready for deer season, and look, there's probably a lot of people within the hunting industry, they're going to completely think I'm full of crap here and they're going to give me a hard time about it. But the truth of the matter, the God's honest truth of the matter is that you can just go to the surplus store and get some cotton BDUs. And spend the money that you save not buying all the fancy Drake stuff and get yourself some scent spray. In between deer hunting season, store that camo in a burlap bag with some leaves and bullcrap in them from the local area. And, you know, don't worry about it so much. I mean, especially if you're spotting and stalking or if you're turkey hunting, you got to have some great camo.
Different animal.
Yeah, it's a different animal. But for deer, it's like, sure, if you're spot stalking, that sort of hunting where you're walking around, you might want to probably consider your camo a little more carefully. But if you're hunting in a ladder stand, an enclosed blind, you know, a ground blind, the camo that you use is really not quite as consequential as you might think. I mean, depending on the weather, I've hunted deer in shorts and t-shirts.
Many times.
I've hunted deer in blue jeans. And I've hunted deer in blue jeans sitting in a ladder stand and had huge bucks walk up on me. Mm-hmm. But I was also still.
Yep.
I was quiet. I was still. I controlled my scent. And it all comes down to how you get in the stand, how you approach the stand can make or break your hunt for that morning or evening, right? Knowing the way the winds are coming in and the direction that you think the deer might be coming in. We didn't even talk about trail cameras. That's one thing that I wanted to discuss a little bit. I'm a big believer in trail cameras. We can probably, look, we can hit on that real quick, and that can be the last thing. And honestly, really, trail cameras should have been one of the first things on the list because trail cameras are your ultimate resource for reconnaissance, right? The more times you go out and physically inspect a hunting area, you're spreading your scent around. Like you're educating the deer that, hey, there's something here that it doesn't belong here. They may not know what you are. They just know you're something that doesn't smell natural to them and that, you know, they are just programmed to associate human scent with danger. That's just after thousands and thousands of years of evolution on their part. They have just learned that, hey, when I smell that, something's up and I shouldn't be.
I mean, you know, humans do the same thing. If you walk into a room and you smell like ammonia, like chemical smell, your brain is like, this is not safe to breathe or there's danger here. Mm-hmm. You need to about face and leave.
True.
Deer are the same. They smell something funky and they're like, you know what? I need to get out of here.
They are.
Bye. And just leave.
And those, so those cameras are super important. Now, I like the cameras that have the cell phone Wi-Fi type thing that sends it to your phone. I've got those set up through Moultrie. Unfortunately, a few years ago, some dirtbag stole one of my freaking cameras and modems. And, you know, those things, if you know what they cost, they're not cheap. I've got two Moultries set up with the modems. I'm probably going to pick up a third one. I like the Moultries. The battery life is good. The service is excellent. I'm a fan. The unlimited data plan, I think, is like $35 a month, which can be kind of pricey. But you can, if you want, you can only have it set up like half a year if you want. So if you don't want to watch the deer during the summer, you don't have to. But I would suggest getting your cameras in as soon as possible. I mean, like when you go and plant your food plots and get, you know, maybe your food established, that's when you want to go ahead and get your cameras established and get them taking photos so you can start establishing patterns, yes, counting the deer. You know, and starting to learn like, okay, this doe who comes in, she's got, you know, a spot on her ear, and she's always got three fawns with her. After a while, you'll begin to kind of get a lay of the land and go, oh, okay, there's my doe with her three fawns, or there's my two bucks, or here's my big buck that comes in, and he's got a tine facing this way. So after a while, you'll begin to identify the deer, and you'll begin to sort of name them and everything. So that can be a great way to keep tabs on who is showing up to your deer stand and what kind of animals are coming through. And also, you might have animals coming through that you need to deal with that are problem animals. So what if you look on your deer camera and you've got five hogs, a sounder of hogs comes through three times a day and decimates your pile of corn, and the deer aren't even getting to it? Well, you would, if you didn't have a camera, you would assume that every time you show up and put out corn, oh my gosh, these deer are hungry. They're eating the crap out of this corn. And you wouldn't even know that it was hogs eating the corn and not the deer.
That's right.
So that's important to know.
It also picks up trespassers, which are prevalent. I mean, people,
we've seen trespassers on camera.
People like to, you know, like they want to take advantage of the fruits of your labor. So why do they need to do all the work and invest all the money when they can come in and hunt your land, use your corn, and they're poaching your best deer, you know? Yeah. So
most of the times, if we see somebody on camera that doesn't belong there, it's usually a neighbor trying to, you know, come over and look for a deer they shot or something like that. It's usually someone we know, so we don't make a big deal about it. And like the unwritten rule of the road on like private land with that sort of thing is like most property owners, if you just give them a call and say, hey, I shot a deer, he ran over to your property, like it's cool. They're going to say, absolutely. Yeah, go retrieve your deer. Like, it's cool. They're going to be fine about it. And likewise, you know, like we get a call, someone says, hey, my grandson shot a deer, ran over the fence. We'll go help them look for it. Like, that's fine. We want to totally help them, you know. So we all look after each other in that regard. But cameras can be a great way to establish patterns in your deer, to count the deer on your property, to know if there are animals coming on the property, eating your food or getting in your food plot that you don't want, that maybe you have to deal with. They're a pest. You know, you can see coyotes, bobcats, turkeys, any animal that comes in front of that camera, you're getting an instant bit of background on what's going on in your property. So cameras are a great investment. The modem versions can be quite expensive. The service plans can cost a bit. But if you and your buddies want to just kind of go in on some cameras and split the cost, that is a great way for everyone to have access to that account and pull it up on their phone. And, you know, you and I have done it. Well, I'll send you a picture. Like, did you see that deer? And I'll send you the picture. You go, holy crap.
Yep.
And that's fun, too. That's part of the process. So we're actually going to do that, is get our cameras set up soon. So.
And it also depends on, you know, when you look at that type of stuff, it's an investment. So you either fall into two camps. You either have one or two, and it's not too expensive, or you have like 10. And if you have 10, you're more than likely leasing a property that costs, you know, a lot of money, and you're splitting that cost between, you know, 10 or 15 guys. So the burden isn't too bad, but those are just things to take into consideration.
We generally run two or three cameras a year with the modems, and we split the cost on them. Batteries, I would say, just as a footnote, each modem and camera uses 8 batteries. So that's 16 batteries per camera. And I would say with a reasonable amount of activity, those cameras and modems probably last about 20 to 30 days before, you know, you got to replace the batteries about once a month.
Yep. So you're trekking in there, you know, trying not to be too disruptive, because when you're in there, you still have to, you know, be mindful of, you know, the stuff around, because you don't want them to feel pressure. Like, oh, here comes Eric again, just trudging through our house.
Here comes Jim Bob.
Yep.
So I think that covers things pretty well. I mean, when we get into deer hunting season, these are the things that are on our minds. These are the things that we're thinking about. These are the processes we're going through. So some of you that are new to deer hunting, maybe you don't know what kind of stuff you might want to consider, or maybe you need a refresher. We wanted this podcast to sort of dive into what we go through and what we think about when it comes to getting ready for deer season. So hopefully this helps some of you. I did answer many questions that lots of folks have asked me over the years, and I tried to share some stuff with you that we kind of learned the hard way. So maybe you can take that knowledge and be more successful this year in the deer stand. I hope that you all have a great year hunting, and I'm looking forward to putting out this content. It's going to be so much fun, dude.
Last piece of advice, Wait till it gets cold. Wait for the cold snap. We've all made the mistake of being overly ambitious and overly eager to get out there and sitting in a hot stand. And
ooh, you're going to make some people mad with that. Look, there are people that have great success in the early hunt. Early rut, or maybe, you know, look.
Not in South Georgia, I'll tell you.
Look, everyone has their own opinions about when you should get in the stand. I personally, I agree with Matt. I'm the kind of guy that I'm not going to really start hunting hardcore until the first good cold snap. Mm-hmm. Those deer will be moving like crazy, but we're hunting in South Georgia. Georgia, that seems to be, you know, kind of the consensus. Like, it'll turn on. It'll be dead for a while and it'll turn on. But your results may vary. So don't be afraid to get in the stand. I mean, here's the thing. You're an observer. Okay. Take a gun, take a bow, whatever. Sit in the stand. Don't treat hunting like, all right, I have to go shoot something today. Hey, get out there, get in the stand, observe. All right, what did you see? Did you see anything? All right, why didn't you see anything? Did you have good wind? All right, count the deer. How many deer did you see? Any shooters? I mean, you don't have to go to shoot a deer. You can go to observe and just carry a gun. You don't have to shoot a deer. You can just watch them. And sometimes you'll learn a lot more about deer behavior by just watching them instead of shooting them. And that tends to be the problem that a lot of people get into is they think, well, I got to get out in the woods and get my first deer for the year. Go ahead and, you know, pop the cherry for the year on my deer. Well, maybe watch them for a while. Observe them, because you learn about deer behavior the most by observing deer. If they walk right in and the first thing you do is just shoot the first one you see, you're not going to be able to observe their behavior and learn how they act if you don't observe them. So maybe that would be my last piece of advice.
Yes.
Don't be afraid to observe them.
That is great advice.
All right. Guys, thanks so much for tuning in this week. I hope you all have had a great week, and I can't wait to get out and hunt this year. I'm looking so forward to hunting season. I know Matt is too.
Oh, yes.
I got you. You're a convert.
Oh, yeah.
You're on now.
We're getting it done every year now.
All right. Well, guys, thanks so much. Have a great week. Many more podcasts on the way. Make sure you go over to Ballistic Inc. and pick yourself up a snazzy new t-shirt. That's one way you can support our efforts here on LLP. Thank you so much. Many more on the way. We'll see you soon.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.